Hello and welcome to the Geneva Health Files podcast. I am Preeti Patnaik, the founding editor of Geneva Health Files, a weekly investigative newsletter that explores power and politics in global health. In this episode, we discuss the changing landscape of global health governance and financing. I'm very pleased to bring you today insights from Peter Sands, who has led the Global Fund for more than half a decade now. Sands is seen as someone who brings much-needed clarity to global health policymaking and a quiet determination to address the intractable challenges of deep-rooted diseases. The Global Fund invests $4 billion a year to fight HIV, TB, and malaria, and has raised more than $15 billion in 2022 in the previous replenishment round. When Sands was chosen in 2017 to lead the fund, they were the usual detractors, but many would admit that global health has got richer on account of his leadership. In this comprehensive interview, Sands, a former banking chief, cuts through the chase and tells it like it is. From financing for pandemic preparedness and response, to the urgent global health implications of climate change, to his more nuanced views on innovative finance, Sands spoke with Geneva Health Files in the summer of 2023. He chooses his words carefully and shares his considered views on both the technical and the political aspects in global health. Hi, morning. How are you?
I'm very well.
Thanks so much for your time. So to begin with, you know, I would really like for you to tell us about the role of the fund in the post-COVID scenario, the role of the fund in pandemic preparedness. I had a look at your strategy, but really it would be good to know your thoughts on this.
Look, we've always played a role in pandemic preparedness, even when we weren't explicitly doing so. And indeed, there was an interesting article in The Lancet in February 21, which looked at the fact that about a third of global fund investments contributed to pandemic preparedness, because we are the largest multinational provider of grants for health systems. And because we are, our core mission is around fighting infectious diseases, we're investing in all the components of health systems that are vital to prevent, detect, respond to any kind of infectious disease threat. So, and we saw that play out in practice in the COVID-19 pandemic, because for many countries, if you actually look at the way they responded, much of the infrastructure they were using, the people, the systems, the technology, the molecular diagnostics, the laboratories, the supply chain, was all stuff that we had invested in and built for fighting HIV, TB, and malaria. The difference that's embedded in the strategy is now to ensure a bit more intentionality, so that when we're investing in laboratory networks or disease surveillance systems, to do it very deliberately with a multi-pathogen perspective, so that we're looking beyond the immediate diseases and helping countries build capabilities that will provide better ability to prevent, detect, respond to future threats, whatever they are. And you're seeing this in a whole range of different types of investments we're doing, like whether it's in wastewater surveillance or enhancement of mobile x-ray or molecular diagnostics, or the way we're building out supply chains, or even the way that the sort of community health worker networks are being developed. I mean, obviously, in the pandemic itself, we played a significant role through our COVID-19 response mechanism. So in terms of grants, we were the largest provider of grants for lower middle-income countries for everything other than vaccines. So COVAX did vaccines, but we did a huge amount on diagnostics, on PPE, on oxygen, on enhancements to health systems. You know, some countries needed rapid enhancements to their supply chain or to their intensive care units, or, you know, a whole range of different things that needed to be. Community systems has been a significant aspect. And we're continuing to use both our core grant portfolio and C19RM for investments in these components of health systems. One thing I would emphasize is this point of integration. A very high proportion of the things you want to invest in for pandemic preparedness are the things you want to invest in anyway for fighting existing infectious diseases. You might argue that there's some aspects of zoonotic spillover type stuff that are specific to pandemics, yeah. But the core health system stuff is basically the same stuff.
Right. This is interesting. But, you know, a lot of the discussions in current global health negotiations, whether it's the pandemic accord or amendments to the international health regulations, there isn't a lot of emphasis in terms of specific language on health system strengthening. There's a lot of it is about response and not so much prevention. I wonder how you feel about it. You know, the emphasis is on, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to share countermeasures and this, that, and the other, but not so much. I mean, that's concerning at least developing countries in terms of how do we craft obligations on health systems strengthening in these new rules?
I mean, I think there's two answers to that question. One is the bias towards response has always been there. Between Standard Chartered and the Global Fund, I spent some time at Harvard doing work on things like the interaction between finance and economics and pandemics. And it's a bit sad looking at some of the things I wrote then because nobody was paying attention. But at the time, that was one of my arguments against things like the Pandemic Emergency Facility, is that I felt it was putting too much political capital and emphasis on response rather than on preparedness. I'm not sure whether a sort of rules-based approach to health systems is ever going to be massively effective, because the way health systems work and the needs of the communities are very context specific. But on the other hand, I think the concern is absolutely right, which is that we should be investing more in the health systems components, because actually people get very excited by, and rightly, about access to medicines and so on. But then you very quickly run into the bottleneck that is the health systems themselves and their ability to deliver. I always make the point that people always get more excited about fire engines than they do about things like fire building codes and fire retardant materials. But if you want to understand what has made the biggest difference in reducing deaths due to fires, it has not been improvements in fire engines. Yeah. It's been improvements in fire retardant materials, building codes, and all the kind of nitty-gritty preparedness and prevention stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what we've got to do. But I would also keep insisting on this fact that we can't see it as a bright line between this is for existing diseases and this is somehow for pandemics. I look at the inequities around this area and, you know, obviously there's a set of inequities that everybody focuses on, which is the inequities around access to medical countermeasures, right? They didn't get vaccines, they didn't get, diagnostics and so on. That's the obvious one. There's a slightly more subtle one, which is who gets to decide what gets treated as a pandemic.
Yes.
Right? Because I can tell you, if you had a disease that arrived tomorrow, that it was in every country in the world, that 10 million people a year fell sick of, that killed over 1.5 million people, had a fatality rate higher than COVID-19. So imagine a new disease like that. It would be called a pandemic. It's TB.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so my worry is that if we allow there to be a kind of particular set of things that are, in a sense, privileged for pandemics, and pandemics are only defined, and of course this would never be explicit, as things that might threaten to kill people in rich countries, then we actually inadvertently widen the inequities within global health.
Yeah, that's obvious. And that's where it's so contested and so political, who gets to decide what gets treated as a pandemic. Just moving into the bread and butter stuff, which is on financing, a couple of, you know, related questions. What does the expanded role of Global Fund mean in terms of the size of the envelope going forward, if you are actually going to really get big on PPR financing? And the larger question is, how do you prevent fragmentation of global health financing? There are a couple of pieces to this, right? Not just a World Bank fund, but also countries now have some language on financing mechanism, like the Green Climate Fund, perhaps affiliated to WHO member states. But of course, there's hardly any appetite for anchoring any kind of a new financing mechanism for PPR in the scheme of WHO for a variety of reasons. People don't trust the WHO, but I think a lot of countries want this to be like a multilateral system, not the way the pandemic, you know, the financial intermediary fund, for instance, is structured. So yeah, I think it is connected to what does it mean in terms of size of your operations if you, you know, if you do get into this in a big way.
Well, I mean, in a sense, we are in this in a significant way, and we invested more in total and more in health systems last year than we've ever done, and we will do more this year. Now, where that goes in the future will depend on, you know, the appetite of donors and how this whole debate unfolds around financing mechanisms and so on. I suppose the point I would be making is, ultimately, we've got to work out a way that works for countries and is efficient and effective. And as you say, there is significant fragmentation. And the trouble is it tends to be that the institutional and political motivations here tend always to be to create new institutions. This creates real difficulties at a country level. I would argue that the global health space is too fragmented already, and that we impose too great a burden on countries in terms of different reporting mechanisms, different assurance mechanisms, different governance requirements, and so on, and different timeframes in which to organize things. And so far, despite a lot of rhetoric around wanting to sort of simplify and make it more responsive to country needs and things like this, actually what we've done is made it more complicated.
Yeah.
That, I think, is something that we need to think very hard about, because we're actually making the deployment of the money less efficient. And we've got to appreciate that in many of the countries that are most in need, the sort of leadership bandwidth to deal with requirements is extremely limited. And even if they can do it, in a sense, you're diverting them from doing better things they should be doing.
Right.
Because much of this stuff is actually quite challenging to implement, particularly in resource-constrained environments. You know, if you want to do gene sequencing of pathogens based on wastewater surveillance in an environment where wastewater processes are, let's say, uneven, there's quite a lot of work to do to put that kind of thing in place. Distracting people from writing sort of multiple submissions or reports to different funders, all supporting the same thing, is not optimal.
Yeah. Just to quickly follow up on that, this emphasis on raising resources domestically, you know, there are limits to that as well, shrinking fiscal space and so on. What are your thoughts on that, you know, as a former banker? People want to say, okay, countries should fix this themselves, raise resources domestically. There's only so much we can do at an international level. But that's not so easy, right?
No, it isn't. And also, it's very hard to generalize, because when you're talking about low and middle income countries, you're talking about some countries which have very significant financial resources and ability to do things themselves. But you're also talking about countries which are extremely fragile have no fiscal capacity and frankly have higher priorities because they have, you know, very high maternal death rates. They have very high infant mortality. And pandemic preparedness is something with very high externalities.
Right.
That everyone in the world benefits from each country getting better at it.
Yeah.
And therefore, it is something that it makes sense for other countries to support. And we can't expect the poorest countries to pay for it themselves because it wouldn't make sense for them to do so. And they don't have the resources. One of the problems of some of the discussion around pandemic preparedness and response is it becomes very state-driven and technocratic.
Mm-hmm.
Very much about the medical response, very much about what the governments are doing. Those are important elements. But one thing we have found in 2 decades of very successful fighting against infectious diseases is that if you don't have the communities as part of the fight, then you won't win. You're much more powerful. And indeed, if you look at the success or failure of many countries' COVID-19 responses, a lot of it was around, could governments actually get societies to trust them? Or could they sway people to do what they wanted them to do? And so the whole community and people aspect of pandemic preparedness, I fear, gets a bit lost. And yet, one of the biggest assets you have when you run into one of these situations is trust. You build trust by engaging people, but you also build trust by delivering on their needs now.
Mm-hmm.
Tedros has told a story of going to an Ebola outbreak in Kivu in northeastern DRC. And the usual thing of a phalanx of UN vehicles and everybody suited up and all this sort of stuff. And being met with kind of some hostility by the local people who basically said, you know, I'm paraphrasing him, so, but basically said, in effect, you're all terribly interested because we've had one Ebola death here. None of you were interested when we had 3 children die of malaria last month.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think we have to build an approach to pandemic preparedness and response that engages communities and that also doesn't draw a distinction between their existing needs in fighting infectious diseases and their potential future needs. Because you can't just turn up when something that might threaten other parts of the world and expect people to take you seriously.
Right. No, it's great that you bring up the aspects on community. I've heard that you are really a champion of community concerns. I've heard that from so many people here. Just moving very specifically to what you thought was the effectiveness of innovative financing in dealing with some of the resource constraints in global health. You don't seem to be a fan of this. You also kind of sounded skeptical on debt swaps. Both of these proposals are sort of gaining traction, not only in global health, but also climate finance, for example. It seems to be the favorite buzzword in the development space. And we know that, you know, other global health agencies are really invested in this kind of innovative financing mechanisms and also bringing the potential WHO replenishment that could include in the future as one of the options, also innovative financing. Tell us why you're skeptical about innovative financing. The related question is, this whole thing is built on payments by results, right? People want, they want specific indicators, but health and development do not work in this manner. And I think private investors know that there's a lot of interest in impact investing and so on. But so how do we square this circle? This is being bandied about as a potential policy option.
It's not that I'm against innovative finance. And actually, I want to be clear, we do debt swaps.
Right.
I can't remember the precise number, but over $250 million. I think it's like $260 million of debt swaps already. And we are actively pursuing other debt swap arrangements. We also do blended finance deals in which we essentially subsidize the interest costs on MDB loans to incentivize countries to use them for health purposes.
Yeah.
So we do those. But let's be clear, both of those are essentially taking different forms of overseas development assistance. They're not generating new money.
Yeah.
You know, doing a debt swap of a concessional debt and turning it into and having that forgiven and turned into health is a good thing to do, but it's not new money.
Right. Yeah.
The issue I have with some aspects of innovative finance is they're dressed up to be what they're not. And people aren't looking at the underlying economics, and they aren't being sufficiently rigorous, and they're pretending that the private sector is involved when actually the private sector is making money out of the thing.
Yeah.
Unless we're very clear about what's actually happening in these transactions, we run the risk of kidding ourselves. Because there's political imperative often to, you know, find new sources of money and get the private sector involved,
yeah,
there's often a bit of a desire to kind of rush over those bits. And, you know, the pandemic emergency facility was a flawed concept from the beginning.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. And things like IFIM, which is perfectly sensible as a way of encouraging governments to spread their commitment over a longer period. But we shouldn't kid ourselves. The private sector doesn't put money into it. The private sector makes money out of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then on the payment for results side, there are some opportunities to do payment for results. I should think the Global Fund does more with private sector partners than anybody else in the global health space. And we have a lot of complicated structures with which we work. But we should be very clear. If we want to meet the needs of the very poorest on issues that are around basic systems and saving lives, we shouldn't kind of kid ourselves that innovative finance is the way to do that. It's not going to be the solution to doing that. And I have a little bit of a worry if we put too much attention into that, mm-hmm. it's a kind of excuse for not saying, actually, what we need is for the donor governments in the world to be prepared to put their hands in their pockets to make grants. Because if we make it too complicated and all we're doing is increasing the transaction costs,
yeah,
there is a role for innovative finance, but there's bad innovative finance and good innovative finance. And we need to be very thoughtful about where we use it. And it shouldn't be an excuse for actually not delivering on overseas development assistance.
Right. So just moving on to the governance question, you brought up, higher commitments from donor countries. And I think the conversation in global health right now is, yes, it's great that, you know, we have certain institutions where donors have a role to play and are playing a influential role. But in spaces like, say, the WHO, you know, it's a multilateral system and you have all countries around the table and so on. This is, of course, unfolding also in the context of the larger drive towards, decolonizing global health and so on. At the Global Fund, what is the way forward in terms of making it more inclusive than it already is? What do you think of this debate about decolonizing also global health governance? And for an institution like the Global Fund, like others where donors have a substantial amount of say, how would you balance this? The social sort of objective of making it more inclusive, while at the same time there are realities, right? Because donors control this stuff.
Actually, I think the Global Fund already has one of the most inclusive governance systems in the global health and development landscape. We have 20 voting seats
yep.
on our board.
Yep.
Three of them are for civil society. And they're balanced between donors and implementers, and they also include private sector. Because it isn't just about rich countries and poor countries, it's also about non-state actors.
Mm-hmm.
Much of the debate is about country versus country. I think that's important, but it's not the whole story.
Yeah.
And the inclusion of non-state actors is really important. So five of our voting seats are non-state actors in total. But the other thing about the Global Fund model, which is different from many other organizations, is what countries do with the money that we give them is set by them, because we have these country coordinating
yeah.
mechanisms,
yes.
right? And again, they are not only the government. The policies around the country coordinating mechanisms is they have to be inclusive of different components of society, including NGOs, communities, private sector, and so on. And so the whole idea is, I think, consistent with some of the themes around decolonializing global health, is that actually we should be an enabler of what countries and communities are seeking to do, and that the governance mechanisms, both at the global level and at the country level, are sort of designed to facilitate that. Now, of course, you can always be enhancing, and we are continually sort of tweaking and enhancing them. But the model is definitely not a donor-driven board with donors telling countries what they're going to do with the money. That just isn't the way the Global Fund works or has ever worked.
I guess it's the question more on representation, the fact that, of course, not all countries are around the table. So what's ailing global health? What keeps you awake at night?
One thing I think we are in danger of is focusing too much on the last issue, the whole fighting the last war problem, which is not to say we shouldn't be concerned about pandemic preparedness, but the reality is climate change is changing the rules of the game in global health right now. And it's killing people right now.
Yeah.
Collectively, we are behind the game in our response to that. And we're not properly linked in with the whole climate change community. And, you know, the global health consequences of climate change are only barely on the agenda.
Yeah.
That is a real problem. Because if you look at what happened in Pakistan last year, if you look at what's happened in Mozambique and Malawi, just been to Chad. I mean, this is with us. This is real. And the interplay of that and conflict is creating a dynamic where we need to be thinking differently about notions of resilience. So, you know, the notion of resilience in a climate change context is different from resilience in a kind of next COVID-19 context.
Right.
One of the things that we've seen in conflict situations, civil society networks and so on are one of your strongest ways of ensuring continuity of service in conflict. So that's my main thing. I also think that we get too wrapped up in our internal debates and not focused enough on this, what's actually happening in the world, and that the answer of the global health community to every problem is to create something new, which just makes an already overly fragmented ecosystem even more fragmented. In the global financial services world, the number of institutions that really make a difference, the IMF, the World Bank, the FSB, the BIS, that's it really. And they all have significant resources and authority and all that kind of stuff. And then the global health landscape, just the profusion of entities. But I'd say, I think the biggest thing for me is this, we're in a world where the combination of climate change and conflict is going to be driving the dynamics of global health. And we need to have our act together to respond to that, because otherwise the health consequences will end up fueling the political and conflict issues as well.
Right. And do you miss banking or?
No, I mean, I love what I do. I enjoyed what I did then, but I like what I do now.
All right. This was supremely helpful. Thank you so much for your time.
We hope you found this interview to be useful at a time when financing for pandemic preparedness and response dominates multiple forums in international development. Global health must open up and pay attention to external perspectives and transcend internal debates, as Sans told us. It is refreshing when leaders in global health speak their mind and bring a dose of pragmatism to policymaking, particularly in Geneva. For more interviews like this and for deeper analysis on global health, check out our investigative newsletter Geneva Health Files on Substack by visiting genevahealthfiles.substack.com or follow us on social media at FilesGeneva on Twitter. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, goodbye.